From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Ralph Allen. He's the creator of the Broadway musical Sugar Babies and an expert on the history of burlesque. Also today, I talk with photographer Tony Mendoza. His new book, Stories, blends words and pictures into a quirky autobiography. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles Sonny Burgess, one of the pioneers of 50s rockabilly music. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Boys of Winter, the new novel by Wilfred Sheed. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is Ralph Allen. He's the creator and writer of the Broadway show Sugar Babies, which was a burlesque musical. Allen describes Sugar Babies as the burlesque of your dreams, where all the comedians are funny, all the women beautiful, and all the skits perfectly orchestrated. That was not necessarily the case in theaters like The Troc in Philadelphia or The Gaiety in Baltimore during the heyday of burlesque in the 20s and 30s. Sugar Babies was the outgrowth of Allen's interviews with burlesque comedians and performers when he was researching burlesque at the University of Pittsburgh. Sugar Babies opened in San Francisco in 1979 and closed 7 years later on Broadway after 2,500 performances, all of them starring Mickey Rooney and Ann Miller. Sugar Babies has been produced by companies throughout the United States and in many other parts of the world. It's currently a hit in Australia, and the latest American production is about to open in Atlantic City. Ralph Allen now teaches at Queens College in New York City. He served as producer and theater consultant to the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., and he also wrote the book for the Broadway musical Honky Tonk Nights, which was about black vaudeville. Ralph Allen, welcome to Fresh Air.
Nice to see you, Terry.
When did you start going to burlesque theaters?
Well, I started sneaking into burlesque theaters about 1948 or 49, I guess, to the Troc in Philadelphia. I grew up in Philadelphia. My father, who was much taken with fantasies of my failure, as all fathers are, were sure that it was going to be the ruin of me. But I don't suppose anything in my life was more profitable than sneaking away from school and going to those burlesque theaters, because it led to this extremely successful show.
Did you have to sneak in? It sounds like you were underage.
Well, in 1948, I was pretty young, and I don't think you were supposed to go unless you were 18. I was under 18 then.
So this was the late 40s. What was the state of burlesque then?
Well, it was in its decline then, really, the end of burlesque. Those of us who love the form and love the comedians who took part in it feel that when burlesque became kind of pornographic, it sort of died, really, for most of us, although the comedians who had performed in the early days continued to play because they had nowhere else to play until they were in their 80s. Burlesque became pornographic, if you will, or vulgar at least, in about 1930. Three things happened to live entertainment at the end of the 20s. First of all, radio brought free entertainment into the home for the first time. Movies developed sound. And, of course, there was a stock market crash. And under this triple pressure, the big vaudeville circuits died. And burlesque stayed alive by doing the things that radio couldn't do and the movies couldn't do. And that's when burlesque became a little decadent, I guess.
Well, you were going in the late 40s, and I wonder if people went to burlesque houses the way they go to X-rated movie theaters now and slip in hoping that nobody notices them, sit far away from other people.
Well, it had that feel by the time I started to go, I guess, really. I really did love watching those old comedians, and it occurred to me later when I became a theater historian that no one was recording these stock scenes that they played and recording this style of comedy, and that somebody ought to do it. And so I began systematically to record their material and to talk to them.
What's the difference between the kind of comedy and musical variety you'd find in burlesque as opposed to vaudeville or musical comedy?
Well, briefly, the difference between vaudeville and burlesque. Variety entertainment around the turn of the century really was of three types. There were the minstrel shows, first of all, and they were in their last days at the turn of the century. They were entertainments, kind of pseudo-folk entertainments created by white people for white people, but using as a as a clown image, blackface minstrel, blackface kind of plantation slaves. And this entertainment was on its way out, and the two new forms of variety entertainment were vaudeville and burlesque, both of which were organized around the turn of the century. The first big vaudeville circuit started in 1904, and the first big burlesque circuit started in 1905. Vaudeville was simply a miscellaneous collection of variety acts with no internal coherence. You'd have a juggler, and then you'd have a singer or a song and dance team and so forth. And these, someone would do 10 minutes and then go home. Burlesque was a kind of poor man's musical comedy. It was not a review in those days. It actually had a book, but a very loose book. And it was centered on the comedians who played stock characters and played stock scenes, in fact. And these stock scenes were sometimes inserted into a plot, but and sometimes not. But the word burlesque is an Italian word. It comes from burla, to fool around in comedy. It has really nothing to do with taking off your clothes, which is what burlesque came to.
Yeah, you haven't mentioned taking off your clothes yet.
It came to mean. Well, as I say, striptease started in the 30s, really, and that's sort of the end of it, as far as I'm concerned, really, the end of the glorious period of burlesque.
You've had a long career as a professor of theater and directing plays by Molière and Shakespeare.
29 years, actually.
Did your colleagues think you were a little flip trying to do research into burlesque?
Yeah, I guess maybe they did, some of them. There's a kind of theater that I like to call the theater of middle seriousness.
know, That's pretty good.
And there is a certain kind of person who finds this sort of entertainment demeaning and low. But I think real intellectuals like low comedy, actually. There's a good reason for it. I mean, burlesque is low comedy, and I don't mean that to denigrate it. That's just a description of the kind of comedy it is. Raucous, unsentimental, tough-minded. There's nothing of Charlie Chaplin's kind of humor in burlesque, you know, nothing, no sentiment at all, really. And that's its appeal for me. I guess it's wish fulfillment comedy of the highest sort. The scenes are based on the relationship between an authority figure, a straight man, and a kind of cunning man of instinct who succeeds to the consternation of his glibber partner. And all of us, with part of our minds at least, want to be free of education, free of all those constraining influences. And I think burlesque appeals to that anarchic impulse in us. But the anarchy is never threatening, you see. It's contained within an orderly structure, and therefore it's exhilarating rather than depressing. Let me put the appeal of it this way, it seems. Most comedy in our century is either sentimental, like most television situation comedy, or to avoid being sentimental, like a lot of avant-garde comedy, it's bitter and cynical about human nature. Burlesque charts a course between the rocks of cynicism and the shoals of sentiment, so to speak, and most comedy in our century is battered by the one or beached on the other. And burlesque manages to be, the image presented by these burlesque comedians, managed to be cheerful without being sentimental, unsentimental without being bitter, and I think that's its appeal.
Ralph Allen is my guest. He's an expert on burlesque, not by virtue of performing in it, but by virtue of writing it. He wrote and co-created the show Sugar Babies, which was a Broadway musical for many years and has traveled around the world, is currently in Australia, about to open in Atlantic City. Let's talk about some of the sketches and some of the people, some of the veterans of vaudeville who you rediscovered. Let's start by playing a sketch for the Sugar Babies cast album.
Okay, sure.
We're going to hear something featuring Sid Stone, who was in the original cast of Sugar Babies.
Yes, he was indeed.
Now, who is he and how did you find him?
Well, Sid Stone actually was only very briefly in burlesque, only for one season, but his style is very typical of that kind of entertainment. He in this sketch you're hearing, he plays what was called in burlesque a candy butcher. A candy butcher was a man who sold souvenirs in the intervals, and he would sell you dirty books, for example, only they weren't really dirty. It was all a sell, and nobody ever bought them twice. But he offered you big combination offers, and we recreated that feature of burlesque shows in the Broadway show, but as a joke. And this is a sketch, really, rather than what a real candy butcher would do.
Okay, so this is a sketch
featuring
Sid Stone.
Sid Stone.
Now, friends, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Through the courtesy and kind permission of the Sugar Babies Company, I'm going to offer a delicious box of Double Dip chocolate-covered candy balls with the nuts on the inside. Now, each and every package contains a handsome and costly little article valued from $5 to $50. But before I can pass the prizes out, I must sell 10 boxes of the candy. Now, as a special added inducement, I'm going to throw in a sensational souvenir imported from Paris, France. It's spicy, daring, risque, and intimate, and dirty. Now, if you're the kind of people that enjoy reading the kind of stories you're never going to find in the Reader's Digest or the Christian Monitor, the kind of stories you're worried your young son is reading when he locks himself up in a bathroom, then this book is just meant for you. Now, neighbors, when you get home tonight in the privacy of your own boudoir, all I want you to do is take this little booklet, turn to the last page, and hold it up to the light. You're going to see the sensual gyrations of a beautiful woman. She moves every muscle in her body, and one of yours.
Mr. Stone.
What
Mr.
is
Stone,
it?
You have a cablegram.
Thanks, kid. Ladies and gentlemen, this wire is for my lawyers in Paris. They inform me there's been an investigation. Some narrow-minded people connected with the United States Customs Department has just confiscated the last shipment of these wonderful, erotic, amatory booklets. So this is your last opportunity to get this sensational collector's item. But remember, friends, I must sell 10 boxes of the candy before I can pass the prizes out. All right, my agent will go amongst you. Who's going to be the first one?
Right,
get
into
this box of candy. Sensational souvenir. Just a minute. Hold the dice. Stop the sale. How many did you sell, Mike?
Five.
How many did you sell, Harry?
Six.
Six and five, that's 11. Sorry, friends, I didn't sell 10. I can't pass the prizes out. Thank you for your kind attention.
That's the late Sid Stone from the cast album of Sugar Babies. Ralph Allen, you were telling me that they sometimes sold virility pills at the burlesque houses.
Oh, yeah, they had all sorts of novelty items that these candy butchers would peddle on you. They'd sell, of course, the spicy little booklets that had been banned on all the newsstands. And then I remember one at the truck who used to sell virility pills, and he'd always warn his customers. He said, boys, when you take one of these pills, they're very strong. Be careful. Swallow it fast. Otherwise, you'll get a stiff neck. And there's a certain color to that kind of style of super salesmanship.
There were a lot of stock sketches in burlesque.
There were all sorts of stock sketches. I mean, burlesque sketches are really divided into two types. There are what are called flirtation scenes, which use only one or two comedians and are played in one in a shallow set and usually about mismatched old men and young women. And then there are what they call body scenes, and there are all sorts of body scenes to choose from. There are hotel scenes, there are restaurant scenes, there are doctor sketches and so forth. And they all had their own stock jokes. And comedians knew these scenes by the name, you know. And if you'd been around burlesque for a long while, you could meet. And in fact, I often saw it. I used to hang around backstage at the truck in Philadelphia. You'd see a comedian come in from Boston, a straight man come in from Buffalo, and they'd sit down a half an hour before the first show, and they'd say, well, what are we going to do? And the one would say, well, do meet me around the corner in the Egg in the Hat and Sweating Like Hell. And they'd go out and do it without a minute's rehearsal. They were stock scenes that everybody knew. That doesn't mean everybody played them the same way. Each comedian would put into the scene his own personality and some of his own business and his own lines. But there were stock jokes that could be used in all the scenes that everybody knew. In courtroom scenes, for example, the district attorney would be sure to tell the judge to stand on his dignity, and the judge would be sure to say, I don't think it'll reach down that far. Or hotel scenes. I'd say, give me a room, and the clerk would say, you want a $6 room or a $5 room? He said, what's the difference? He said, well, the $5 room has a rat trap. The $6 room has a rat trap with cheese. He said, well, give me the $5 room. I'm not hungry, and so forth. So there were all these stock jokes that could be used. It's very much like the Commedia dell'arte, in which comedians chose a role, and they had certain concetti and lotsi. Concetti were kind of stock memorized speeches, and lotsi were stock pieces of business that could be used in scene after scene. We do a schoolroom scene, and Sugar Babies, and we do a courtroom scene. And we do
What's the courtroom scene?
It's called the Westfall Murder Case. There were dozens of courtroom scenes in burlesque. This is about a woman who shot her husband. Mrs. Westfall starts out with a kind of familiar burlesque joke. The judge says, "What's the first case?" And the district attorney says, "We have a case of bigotry, Your Honor." The judge says, "Bigotry, what's that?" He said, "A man's accused of marrying three wives." The judge says, "That's trigonometry," and so forth. So it's that kind of silly, easy kind of humor.
Were the comics who you
Well, I had a lot of favorites. Yeah, I had a lot of favorite comics growing up in Philadelphia. There was a man called Billy Hagen, Cheese and Crackers Hagen, who started in burlesque in 1916 and just died last year at the age of 99. And he was a regular comedian at the Troc when I grew up. And he had been a great star of burlesque in the days when there were big circuits. And he and I became very good friends, and I thought he was the best I ever saw. There was another man that we used in Sugar Babies, who's also now gone, as Sid Stone is, Maxie Furman, who was also somebody I remembered from my youth and who I think was as good as anybody who ever played. There are lots of famous people who started in burlesque, Bert Lahr, Red Skelton.
Sophie Tucker?
Yeah. Fanny Bryce, of course, Gypsy Rose Lee. But comedians like Leon Errol, W.C. Fields. In fact, it's fair to say that any comedian, any low comedian in the United States of a certain age started out in burlesque. Some of them stayed there, and some of the good ones stayed there. Abbott and Costello were a famous pair who escaped. But I've always thought there were lots of people who stayed who were just as good as they were.
My guest is Ralph Allen. He's an expert on burlesque and was the co-creator and writer of the burlesque musical Sugar Babies. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more about burlesque. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Ralph Allen, who is the creator and writer of the burlesque musical Sugar Babies, which is currently a big hit in Australia after its long Broadway run. It's also about to open in Atlantic City, and it's been in production around the world at various times. Ralph Allen is an expert on burlesque.
Yeah, I always used to think of burlesque as a kind of quintessential American form, and when I got to Australia, I found that they had a very similar tradition, and that, in fact, there was a great deal of back and forth between Australia and this country, which really surprised me. It used to take 6 weeks to get there, 7 weeks to get there in the old days, and yet whole troops of American burlesquers would go down there. And a number of the really famous stars of American burlesque were Australian. Leon Errol, for example, who also was a movie comedian for many years, and Willie Edwin. And I suppose that there's something very universal about this kind of wish fulfillment comedy.
You know, I have to tell you that as a woman, in thinking about burlesque, it's almost like thinking about a minstrel show because it's this very male
image
of what a woman should be.
Yeah. Well, it certainly is open to that criticism, I think. And once or twice we've been criticized. I was very careful at putting together Sugar Babies not to use either the racial humor that was so much of a part of it in the early days or what we might call sexist humor. Tastes in humor change, and I tried to avoid the worst of those jokes, but there certainly were plenty of them in burlesque, as there were in every form of popular entertainment during that period. I think the butt of the jokes are always the men, at least in the version we did.
Well, it's funny.
Women always
burlesque.
Get the better of the men.
Well, the women are supposed to be beautiful, and the men are usually kind of dumpy looking in burlesque.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, that kind of joke about mismatched lovers, old men and young women, has been around since Aristophanes and certainly since the Commedia dell'arte. So it remains a kind of simpering false virginity matched with aged lechery is a stock comic situation, which certainly is very much a part of burlesque, but also parts of all sorts of other kinds of popular comedy. There are lots of old men and young women jokes, you know. Old man goes to a brothel, right? And he says to the madam, I'd like one of your girls. She says, old man, you've had it. He says, I have. Who do I pay? and in Sugar Babies, we use a famous one. The old man comes into the hotel scene. He says, I'd like a room for the night. We're honeymooners. We just got married. And the comedian, the straight man who's the hotel clerk, says, have you come a long way? And the girl says, oh, yes, and tonight we're going a lot further. Come on, Daddy, I can hardly wait. And she rushes into the room. The old man says, keep pumping, pal, to his heart. And the clerk says to him, that's a very energetic young bride you have there. He says, yes, she is. He says, but there's such a difference in your ages. Couldn't a honeymoon like this prove fatal? The old man says, hey, listen, if she dies, she dies. And so forth. So there are lots of jokes like that. That's true. And we represent them in Sugar Babies, but we don't dwell on them. We don't build a whole show out of them.
A lot of the burlesque houses were raided, and I think Mayor LaGuardia in New York had a reputation for driving burlesque out of New York into New Jersey.
That was the decadent kind of burlesque that we were talking about that got vulgar and pornographic even in its last days. I mean, it continued into the 60s, but by the 60s, the audiences were sex-drenched, and they hadn't gone there to see the comedians. And the comedians that I knew were all old men by that time. Nobody was learning the material. And they had nowhere else to play, so they continued to play. And occasionally you'd see wonderful comedians in these burlesque houses, but they were playing to audiences who weren't prepared to laugh for the most part, who were there for titillation, not amusement.
After the incredible success you had with Sugar Babies, you had a show called Honky Tonk Nights, that was a musical about black vaudeville, and that show flopped. It got bad reviews, and it didn't stay open very long. Were you prepared for the emotional upheaval of having a flop after having such a big success?
Well, I think if you work in the theater, you know that they come along, that you're very lucky if you have any play that's as successful as Sugar Babies. I mean, that really was kind of the hit of a lifetime. That ran 7.5 years and between New York and the Road and plays all over the world now. But I was very disappointed, of course, when Honky Tonk Nights failed, because we felt it was as good as Sugar Baby, certainly as funny. It was based on a different tradition, really, the tradition of black music hall in New York City. And it was about blacks before the Harlem Renaissance, blacks working in Hell's Kitchen in the west side of New York before they went to Harlem. And I was very disappointed. I'm barely recovered from it now because I worked on it 4 years.
Where did you find the material that you used for that? I think the performers probably would have been older even than the performers from the last.
I did a lot of research into it, of course, at the Schoenberg Collection in Harlem. And it was really, it had a book, you see, unlike Sugar Babies. It was partly a review, but it was about, it certainly took place during a public performance in this music hall, but it was in a fairly undisguised way, the story of Burt Williams, who was the first crossover black performer to become a star in white entertainment. He became a big star in the Ziegfeld Follies. And so I in fact found Burt Williams' old joke book at the Schoenberg Collection. And but, of course, some of the sketches we made up, just as we made up some of the sketches in Sugar Babies. We keep the essence of the entertainment, but we're not slavishly antiquarian in producing it, because if we were, I don't think the modern audiences would enjoy it.
Is it hard to find performers who knew the style that vaudeville needed to be?
Absolutely. We don't
performing.
Have any left. You talked about the late Sid Stone, and Maxie Furman is gone, and Billy Hagan is gone, and lots of people we used in Sugar Babies are gone. 11 people have died since 1979 when we opened Sugar Babies who were associated with the play. And no one is learning that material anymore. And when we do it now, we do it with actors who we have to kind of teach the style to, because nobody is playing that style. Now, Mickey Rooney, who opened in the show and played it for years, was the son of a burlesque comedian. So we were lucky he knew the style. His father, Joe Yule, was a famous burlesque comedian. We're currently doing it in Australia with Eddie Bracken, who certainly remembers burlesque but never performed in it, and in Atlantic City with Rip Taylor, who also is a marvelous comedian who would have been a great burlesque comedian but who had no experience in it.
Have you ever gotten on stage and tried to perform? You're certainly good at explaining what the sketches were like.
No, I'm not really a performer, although I tell jokes once in a while. I'll tell you how Sugar Babies got on. It was kind of interesting. I did it in a regional theater that I ran with an English actor called Anthony Quayle. I was running a very highbrow theater, and we did Everyman and Macbeth and The Duchess of Malfi the year before I did this burlesque show. And it was the bicentennial. It was 1976, and it suddenly occurred to me I better do something American for the bicentennial. And I thought to myself, what'll I do that really represents the spirit of popular comedy in this country? And I thought, well, I'll do a glorious burlesque show. So I did a show in Tennessee at a professional regional theater that I was running with a professional cast. And it suddenly occurred to me that maybe this material had a wider audience than my usual audience of close friends and associates who liked The Duchess of Malfi and Everyman and the things I was doing before. But I had to persuade a Broadway producer to do it. So I gave a paper at a conference of theater historians in New York, a conference on popular theater. One person did minstrel shows and one person did vaudeville, and I did burlesque. My paper didn't have a very scholarly title. It was called "At My Mother's Knee and Other Low Joints." And I invited the producer, Harry Rigby, to hear it. And it's very easy to make academics laugh because most academic papers are very dull. And so I knew sort of if I told some jokes and reconstructed the situation that I could make them laugh. And Rigby laughed too. And he said, you know, we ought to do a show like that sometime. I said, well, here's the script. And so I gave him the script, and he was taken by the idea, and that's how it started, really, out of historical research. I think it's the only Broadway hit ever based on a scholarly paper.
That's probably one of the few scholarly papers based on burlesque. So do you always follow the musical as it travels around the world? I know you just got back from Australia.
No, I don't. I do when there's a reason to. I went to Australia because we had to rewrite some of it. And the producer, Harry Rigby, died a couple of years ago. And his partner, Terry Allen Kramer, went on to other projects. And so sometimes it falls on me to produce it or to put it together. And when I'm asked to, I will do that.
Well, would you like to leave us with any parting one-liners?
I don't know, one-liners.
Or sketch.
Most burlesque humor is very innocent. Take the end of the schoolroom scene as we play it. It ends with the schoolroom scenes in burlesque were always contests between kind of bratty students played by the comedians and the tough-minded administrator of pedagogical justice played by the prima donna. And at the end of the schoolroom scene, she says, it's now time for the lesson of the day. Tell me, what's the difference between prose and poetry? And the comic says, that's easy. The prose stand on the corner. She says, no, obviously you don't know, so I'll have to tell you. If I were to say, my girl went round the mulberry bush and I went round to meet her, that little girl will never know how glad I was to greet her. The comic says, what's that? She says, that's poetry. You see, it rhymes. Oh, he says, meet her and greet her. It does rhyme. He said, but if I were to say, my girl went round the mulberry bush and I went round to meet her, that little girl will never know how glad I was that day. He says, what's that? She said, that's prose. You see, it doesn't rhyme. He says, oh, poetry rhymes and prose doesn't. May I give an example to the class? She says, go ahead. He says, my girl went round the mulberry bush and I went round to meet her. She pulled up her petticoat and I pulled out mine. Now, do you want prose or poetry? So we never say any words. We always said that we had a very clean show and it was only, but it depended on an audience that had a dirty mind.
And with that, Ralph Allen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about burlesque.
Thanks for being here.
My guest has been Ralph Allen, the creator and writer of the burlesque musical Sugar Babies. It's currently a hit in Australia and is also about to open in Atlantic City. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with author and journalist Liz Carpenter. She was press secretary to Lady Bird Johnson and later worked in the Ford and Carter administrations, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, photographer Tony Mendoza talks about capturing his life in words and pictures. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles rockabilly guitarist Sonny Burgess. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Boys of Winter, Wilfred Sheed's new novel about a group of New York writers summering on Long Island. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Today, our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, reviews the early years of rockabilly guitarist Sonny Burgess. Back in the 50s, Burgess had a reputation for being a wild man.
Sometimes you do something just for a joke, and it winds up sticking with you for the rest of your life. In Sonny Burgess's case, it was a simple matter of deciding to dye his hair red, wear a red suit and some red shoes, and play a red guitar. So these days, 30 years after he cut the records that made him a legend among record collectors and rockabilly fans, all anybody ever asks Sonny about is when he turned red. Of course, Redheaded Woman was his first record, but Sonny's own red hair didn't come until much later. The red suit, though, he'd bought right after Sun Records told him that he and his band, the Pacers, would be going on tour with Roy Orbison. He went right down to Lansky's, the famous clothing store on Beale Street in Memphis, and ran into its most famous customer, Elvis Presley. He seemed glad to see a familiar face, Sonny remembered some years later, and he stopped to talk. On a Boogie, with Redheaded Woman on the flip, had sold 90,000 copies for Sun, the company that had propelled Elvis to fame, so Sonny had every right to think he might be next in the rockabilly pantheon. But his producer, Jack Clement, said that Burgess just didn't fit into a groove that we could sell records with, and he had a point. Who'd ever heard of a rockabilly band with a trumpet in it? Who'd ever boast, as Sonny did in Ain't Got a Thing, that I got a woman, but she climbs trees? No, the word for Sonny Burgess is weird, although we might more charitably say he was ahead of his time. After all, in these post-punk 80s, his masterpiece, Sadie's Back in Town, sounds almost normal.
Well, I had a guy
20 years later, Sonny Burgess was selling shoes in Little Rock, Arkansas, and British fans were discovering his records and realizing that rockabilly rarely got any wilder than this. As for the hair, he told Kix magazine earlier this year that, "I had a red suit, but only had my hair dyed red for 3 months. That was a mistake." Hey, Sonny, it was not. It helped them remember you as a wild man, which is why, when you're touring these days with the Sun Rhythm Section, they come out and yell, "We want a boogie!"
Fresh Air's rock and roll historian Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. My guest is photographer Tony Mendoza. Mendoza was born in Havana to a large upper-class Cuban family. They moved to America after Castro came to power. Mendoza worked as an engineer and architect before dropping out to become an art photographer. He's since won 5 photography fellowships, and some of his pictures are in the permanent collections of the Museum of Modern Art and the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Mendoza's first book of photos, called Ernie, was about the escapades of his roommate's tough-looking cat. Many publishers rejected the book because they didn't think Ernie was cute enough. Mendoza's new book is called Stories. It's a series of 45 snapshots from Mendoza's life, each with a simple caption telling the story behind it. The book is unusual. It's part memoir, part family photo album. I asked Tony Mendoza to describe it.
What got me going with stories was to make pictures and the meaning one thing, so there would be no possible interpretation except what I wanted. Many times I've taken pictures and they've been used by people that I've sold it to, the magazine publishers, the media here or there, and they've used the pictures in ways that I never really intended them to be used. The other thing, I guess, is here's a way in which I've been able to write my autobiography without being a writer, and that appeals to me tremendously. I like that idea.
Let's talk about the cover photo for Stories. There's a photograph of 3 women who are up to their shoulders in water. It looks like it's the ocean. They're all wearing sunbonnets, and they have broad smiles on. And it's a photo that would have just looked, I think, almost surrealistic without the caption. Mm-hmm. That you gave it. Would you read the caption?
Yeah, the caption underneath says, "Yeye's sisters, Magda, Tota, and Manana, used to make me nervous. Every time I saw them, they were always laughing. I was afraid to talk to them and run the risk of not being considered funny." That story is very short, one of the shortest in the book, but it's one of the memories that I have from childhood that stick in my mind, and it's when I was a teenager and I was starting to go out, and I was always nervous about whether I was doing it right and whether I was being accepted, and horrible years.
There's a photo in your book of your alarm clock, and would you read what you wrote alongside that photo?
Yeah, the photo is like a studio shot of this alarm clock I've had for like 10 years.
I should say it's a General Electric alarm clock. I've got the same one. It lights up when you plug it in, right?
That's right.
Right.
And the photo, the story, the book has a photo, and on the left, a short story. In 1973, I quit my job as an architect and became an artist. I hated the routine of having to go to work every day, and particularly having to get up at 7 in the morning. I always felt tired and would yawn throughout the day. I became convinced that waking up to an alarm clock was unnatural and would shorten my life. On my last day of work, I walked to the tip of Lewis Wharf and threw my watch and alarm clock into Boston Harbor.
Was there a ceremony that went along with that?
Well, no, but I used to work in that wharf in an architect's office there, and I always would go to the tip of it and sit there and eat lunch, and it felt very appropriate, my last day of work, to throw these things into the ocean. And sure enough, I don't think I've ever yawned again. I rarely yawn anymore. I don't remember ever yawning in a long, long time.
Now, you also have a photo of your father, and he's sitting on a couch. There's a cat behind him.
Uh-huh.
And alongside that photograph, you have a description of your father's reaction to your new choice of vocations
right.
as an artist. Would you read what you wrote about your father's reaction?
Yeah. My father, a businessman, thoroughly disapproved of my artistic lifestyle, my financial irresponsibility, my failure to get married and raise a family, and he didn't understand art. Then during the 70s, Richard Nixon became his favorite political person, and I became equally convinced that Nixon was emotionally disturbed. On my visits to my parents, my father and I would start out talking about safe subjects, sports, family news, how to cook Cuban meals. Then as the evening and scotches progressed, we would grow bolder and start discussing Watergate. Within minutes, the discussion would deteriorate into a yelling match wherein the winner would be judged solely on volume.
Do you still have fights about that?
Yeah, we find new things to sort of fight about. But my father now gets along a little better with me, because I'm a little successful on the surface.
The first photograph that you sold to the Museum of Modern Art is a photograph taken underwater of a man. Would you explain the story behind the photograph?
Well, the picture was taken from above the water, and he was on the water, and I just photographed him head on, and the water was very clear. Basically, it's one of those... A lot of times photographers, you know, don't plan things. Most photographers like to take credit for good pictures, but most of the time they're like accidents. They just things that you never expect, and they happen. I was in this very clear lake in Cape Cod, and I was by the edge of the lake, and I was just marveling at the quietness and the beauty of this lake, and this man who was there, I didn't really know him, he said, Can you take my picture? Because I had this camera around my neck. And I said, sure. And he said, okay. And he just very quietly tiptoed into the lake, very quietly walked into the water and very, very smoothly sank underneath the water and turned towards me. So I creeped up to him, and the water was totally still, like a crystal. And I took the picture, and he was looking at me from under the water. And the effect is kind of very nice, very peculiar.
So you think a lot of photographs are accidents?
Well, I think it's very hard to plan a photograph. I think some photographs in a studio can be planned, but even though sometimes have this funny little things that happen that you never could foresee, that is what makes them special. I think the photographs, when they're good, is when all the pieces kind of fall into place and something kind of mysterious happens.
It seems like you take photographs almost all the time. Does seeing the world through the other end of a lens make you see the world differently? I'm wondering if you think of yourself as trying to freeze time wherever you are.
Well, I love to take party pictures because people are so interesting in parties. Like, I love weddings. They're great parties. It's a lot of fun. But I'm never really participating. I'm never really enjoying because I'm watching everyone else like a hawk looking for interesting pictures. And that in a way is a bad thing about photographs and about being a photographer. And it bothers me a little.
I think I heard somewhere that you're going to be doing more writing and less photographing.
Well, I don't know. I have this kind of peculiar history about professional endeavors, and that is, I first was an engineer, and I moved on, and then I was an architect, and then I did that for a little while, and then I thought, aha, photography, and then I did that for a longer while, and now I've reached a point, gee, writing, isn't that interesting? Wouldn't that be fun? So I have this history. I like the idea of you know, doing something new, moving on. And what that does, I think, is it keeps me young. It also keeps me poor. But but it's interesting. I like it.
Keeps you a constant novice, though, if you do that.
Well, it's true. And you're always in this situation where you're learning. But I remember when I loved photography the most was when I discovered it. Then you get to this point where you acquire the skills, you start doing things, and you start losing some of that wonder, of that excitement, of wondering what you can do with it and what's going to come out. Now, I still love photography. I think it's lots of fun, and it's a very interesting medium, art medium. But writing is interesting to me now because I don't know how to do it, really. I really haven't done any writing. I know very little about it.
Well, Tony, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure. Thank you.
Photographer Tony Mendoza's new book is called Stories. It's published by Atlantic Monthly Press. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you covering today?
Oh, we're covering Oliver North's testimony. It was a kind of a lights-on version of his fundraising slideshow. He says he didn't raise funds. Other witnesses said that after he would show these pictures of the Contras in Central America, they would come out and raise funds. Also, a piece about a new process for deviling eggs, or making deviled eggs, in any case.
Any previews of tonight's All-Star Game?
Yes, we'll be talking with the new director, his debut at directing the telecast of the All-Star Game. His name is John Gonzalez. He'll tell what to watch for in the directions, and also a day with a specialist on the stock market floor.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Wilfred Sheed's last book was a memoir about his parents, Frank Sheed and Maisie Ward, who were prominent Catholic preachers, publishers, and authors. In his new novel, Boys of Winter, Sheed focuses on the New York literary world that summers on Long Island and the games they play, including baseball. Our book critic John Leonard has this review.
Wilfred Sheed, novelist, critic, Book of the Month Club judge, and lapsed Anglo-Catholic troublemaker, would like us to think his new novel is just wicked fun, like those entertainments Graham Greene dashed off when he was weary of wrestling with God. Sheed, though, is not to be believed. He has gone into the lower depths of the New York literary world, which is to say the Hamptons on Long Island. What he finds, besides too much sex and booze, is a different sort of hell, where the author God kills himself, as if to thumb his nose at semiotics and deconstruction and other trendy theories of lit crit the French gussied up after they stopped writing novels anybody normal would want to read. The anti-hero of The Boys of Winter is Jonathan Oglethorpe, a book publisher and Calvinist, quote, descended from one of Cromwell's jackals. He visits the Hamptons to mist his writers as though they were houseplants. He especially cultivates Waldo, a novelist of men at war. He wants to coax one last bestseller from Waldo. Jonathan secretly is writing his own novel about writers in the Hamptons, in which Waldo is a nasty character. Imagine his snit, then, when he finds out that Waldo's novel is also about writers and publishers in the Hamptons, in which Jonathan is a nasty character. And so we read both these novels, plus, of course, Sheed's novel about these novelists, as well as the book in our own heads, populated by real-life Hampton writers like James Jones, Irwin Shaw, Joe Heller, Kurt Vonnegut, George Plimpton, and Sheed himself, from many of whom Sheed may or may not have borrowed this or that quirk of temperament or failure of character. All these novels are about a softball game, dreamed up in a mad vision during the winter by writers in a bar called Jimmy's. The game is played for deadly keeps in the summer, against a team of muscle-bound ringers from Hollywood, for whom the crucifixion and the resurrection would be nothing more than photo opportunities. As a result of this game, a producer almost dies, and a novelist succeeds in doing so, and the reader is turned into an agnostic about reality itself. As we'd expect from the author of The Hack, Office Politics, and Max Jameson, Sheed writes about the protozoa of the literary world, their weird dreams and odd nesting habits, with precision and ferocity and relish. It's always the 4th of July, and the fireworks are wisecracks. Nor is he any kinder to Hollywood and the crabby or mollusk-like Hamptons year-rounders, natives so crusty they have rocks for heads. Everybody in The Boys of Winter satirizes himself until there's no one left to laugh, and that's the rub and scourge. What if we are all characters in somebody else's text, and yet there's only one text, which God didn't write because he was too busy or too tired or too dead to, and that text seems unreliable, although whatever we read somehow happens to us? Imagine, then, a text, this novel, that's a mating of Calvinism and modern science, predestination without grace. Sheed is so glibly funny that we almost don't notice he is also profound.
Book critic John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Boys of Winter, a new novel by Wilfred Sheed. Here's a preview of tomorrow's program. On our next show, I'll speak with brothers Luis and Daniel Valdez, who made the new movie La Bamba about the life of rock star Ritchie Valens. Also, classical music critic Lord Schwartz will review a new album featuring pianist Shura Tchaikovsky, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will discuss efforts in California and around the country to have English declared the official language. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's program was produced by Fred Landrell, with producers Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant, additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Verblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.